Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Born in 1958 in Ravensburg, Germany, Matthias Manson studied with Georg Baselitz and Markus Lupertz at Staatliche Akademie der Bildenden Kunst Karlsruhe. Although he trained as a painter, Manson shifted his focus exclusively to printmaking in the second half of the 1980s. He advances the tradition of woodblock printing by transforming pieces of scavenged wood into printing blocks, which he progressively carves and recarves, using them to create large-scale compositions. The special installation, Matthias Manson Configurations, on view in the West Concourse Gallery from July 23rd through December 13th, 2017, presents 13 woodcuts from the collection of the National Gallery of Art. John Tyson curated the installation during his Andrew W. Mellon postdoctoral fellowship at the gallery. In this conversation, held on September 24, 2017, Manson and Tyson discussed the artist's career, his distinctive process, and the impact of research into subjects from cartography to the U.S. exploring expedition on his artworks. Manson lives and works in Berlin.
I think probably most people who are here have maybe seen it, but if you haven't, we certainly encourage you to have a look at the small installation of these large-scale prints after our conversation. But they consist of kind of three different series. So one, the studio head and feet prints. These works that were made in Paris. And I'm showing you a full installation, but on the left-hand side, and we'll talk about this in greater depth in just a bit, I hope, one of a series of bather works. But to begin with, I think, Matthias, it would be really interesting for everyone to hear a bit more about your process. So how did you go about making these prints, and where were you when you produced them?
The first set we are looking at right now, this is the series called Kopf Studio, Kopf und Füße Studio. It is a reflect. I was at the time in London when I had officially had this postgraduate course in painting. But when I showed up at the school in St. Martin's, they said, "Well, what are we going to teach you? You can have this small room and you can work there." And so I used it as a drawing studio. But this was a different studio. This was in on Clerkenwell Road. And I felt the need to immerse myself, to kind of show how I would be in the studio, how what I would see. There is in each of these images, there's a tiny little bit of the outlook, the Cathedral of St. Paul's. You can see there is the studios. This was the window behind the working table, and there is the one of the big plates that I used to produce these images. And even if these images look maybe like complicated monoprints, but they basically work with two sets of plates. One you can see on the left-hand side.
So why don't I give you this, and you can point it up here.
Point it up here. On the left-hand side, this is a three-part printing block. And here you have also a multiple printing block of multiple boards. Those two basically combined create all the other images. Except here you have a third block. So I'm always asked about how I do this and why I do these things and why does it have to be so complicated. I just can't tell you, because I start with an idea and I bring certain elements together while working. And here you can see a selection of prints that went into the production of the works that are shown next door.
Yep, so I think also one thing that's really unique about your process, so I think people are getting a sense, right, that we have a series of different wooden plates, and these are reconfigured in different ways, so making each impression kind of like a monoprint, even though it fits into a larger series, and there are kind of resonant forms that keep cropping up between the different works. Could you tell us a little bit how you both carve these blocks? And where did these things even come from first?
I mean, my blocks, every time I wanted to create a work, my eyes seemed to key in on pieces of wood or material that I could need. So I never preemptively collect things. I just want to do something, I go out and I find just the plates that I need. And then I take those home. And I'm sure that these plates that are used on the London print, I just found in the streets of London. Mm. Because this has been the case all the time, that I just find these things and then take them home and start working on them. But what should be clear, and I think that's maybe a difference to how woodcuts are usually looked at, I do not start with one plate. For me, the white paper, the empty white paper it is not only a space, but it's also a stage. And on that stage, things will happen. And I bring things together to create these kind of plays, in a way, these happenings.
And could you tell, so we've heard that you pick things up, you kind of scavenge for wood, perhaps there's certainly a chance element, but then when you work the plates, what types of tools do you gouge into these with?
I use regular carpenter tools, gouges, chisels, sometimes I even use mallets to kind of drive them harder. I use very coarse things, like in some cases an axe. You will see on the right-hand side, there is the plates that went into that figure of a bather. And here you see the individual blocks. And the left one, you can see that it's just chopped off with an axe from a board. I use saws in some cases and cut with an electric saw or with a handsaw. You can see these puzzles. This is like a block from a series called About the House. And I mounted it in a state of the last print because a gallery I was working with at the time wanted to show that. We didn't. I was against it. I never showed my blocks so far, but I mounted it.
And I think once, as perhaps slightly ironically, you described yourself as a kind of butcher of blocks that you draw and quarter.
This keeps coming back.
Appeals to art historians, I guess.
Yes, because there is an act of aggression in doing these images. And you must imagine that if I pick up a board like that, some appear to you to be totally black now. And when I start, let's say I would find this table, and I would start, I would ink this table black. And so when I take a chisel and carve something out of that table, it shows up as white light. And I will always, I would bring, let's say I wanted to make a head or a portrait or just an object. I would have sort of an idea of how this should look like. And I would decide on a tool, let's say a flat chisel, and a flat chisel can only do about four or five different things, maybe more, but not many more. And I would decide that, let's say, I would only do this with cross hatches. So that would be an element of an abstract decision to make just little white squares. But I would bring this in the act of carving together to create that image. So I'm, on the one hand, watching what's coming out, so I'm slightly impartial, and on the other hand, I would make that happen. And so the final image that you see and that I see is in some ways also a surprise to me, because I'm bringing two things together, an abstract texture structure and the vision of a head, for instance.
But there's certainly a kind of a selection of tools and an understanding of mark, a certain type of mark making being generated that helps to drive the process.
It is, but this is a decision you have. It's like it is a craft doing a woodcut. So you have to pick up your tool beforehand. You can't, and if you decided on this one tool, let's say a gouge, you can make little dots, or on a chisel, you can make flat strokes. That decides the structure of the image.
And about how many total of these studio head and feet works did you make in total? Do you have a rough sense?
More than 30, I would say. And I would like to point out with two, you can see this figure is just an outline figure, and I did more in the head, mm-hmm. but not much. And if you go over, to this print, you have the same blocks overlaid, but carved slightly further. And here it's recarved again. So this theory is so complicated to explain because I did two things at the same time. I would shift the focus of the image from the figure to the studio, to the ingredients of the studio, the table and all these other things. But I would not only alterate blocks, but I would also recarve the blocks. And that makes it more difficult to explain. And I think if you would, you're an art historian, and people in prints especially, they like this whole idea of states, of development, from a linear development, from like an early image to sort of a more evolved and developed image. In my work, it doesn't really exist. Mm-hmm. You could grab anyone out because I want to see something else, and I take another decision. And then this creates a new image. So, but it's not necessarily going from bad to good, or from. So the whole way of talking about it, I don't think you get that far if you explain all the technicalities.
Yes. Yep. And I think that's an interesting point, that even though you've spent, I guess, most of your career as a printmaker, you're kind of pushing against the conventions of the medium in interesting ways.
I mean, this has something to do with how I got to printmaking. I was trained a painter, and I was at the early 80s. I was sort of slightly disappointed with what I could do. If you look at your hands, painting is usually the last layer of skin, and you can think what's underneath, the bones, the flesh, the muscles, the veins and stuff. But I was always disappointed that in the end, I had just this last layer. And I was doing posters for the art pool for exhibitions and other things. And the easiest way was to do one very large lino cut or wood cut, because we needed only one or two pieces. And after doing those, there was something struck in my mind. There was something that was different than doing a painting. And I thought I could explore that with my own work. And then I realized that it gives me something that I hadn't found in painting, that a print is always, I can keep an image, mm-hmm. but I also record from one image to the next, I record artistic process. Mm-hmm. And this duality, that became the main focus of why I chose that medium, because I always had two things, document and picture.
And as we'll see in a bit, that maybe also kind of relates your work to photography. So it's an expressive medium, but also a documentary medium. Mm-hmm. One more question about these, and then we'll move on to another series. How did you know that you were done with the series?
Very difficult question, because even if I think it's an open-ended process and it begins somewhere and ends somewhere, there is a logical beginning, there is a beginning and there is an end. And usually this is decided by myself not producing another question. Mm. There is just not another one there. Mm-hmm. And then I just stop. Mm. But I think that the most rewarding thing in a day in the studio is always you do something and you walk out, and the next morning you walk in with that question that the work from last evening has left you mm-hmm. with. And so that's, but at some point there is just none, and then it's time to stop.
Some examples of you working in your studio.
Yeah, this is like inking a block. I was working on those bathers image. You see lots of proofs and on left and right, and even some small tiny paintings, because in this series I started with making small paintings as to catch the mode of what I was mm-hmm. wanting to do.
So just to show that you've continued to work perhaps in a somewhat similar way, so surrounding yourself, alternating blocks.
This is my current studio, and I had an exhibition in 2007 in Hamburg in the Kunsthalle, and this was mostly landscape. Mm. The exhibition was called Land and Sea, and there were my landscape prints of the of about 10 years between 2000 and 2007 mm-hmm. or something. And I had suddenly had the idea that there should be one really large work in it, and I did a print that is as long as my studio is long, which is about 9 meters. And in order to make that print, I had to make sort of a carton,
like a cartoon,
mm-hmm. and place and have a sequence, develop a sequence. On the left, you see all the blocks I was going to use, maybe 30, 40 blocks, and I had to have a sequence, and I was, in order not to get too confused, I inked them either white or black and printed on gray paper.
So I think also a nice continuity there with this sort of site specificity, that here it's your studio that's limiting the size of the print and somehow impacting the work. In those works from the studio Head and Feet from the UK, there's a registration of the studio mm-hmm. there as well. The wood is sourced from this very city mm-hmm. that you were wandering around. Yeah. So I think great connections to these different locations.
Same with the About the House series in New York. The large three-panel works were also limited by the size of the mm-hmm. studio.
And so we'll maybe now kind of move backwards in time. So you've already mentioned that you began as a painter, mm-hmm. And as Judith said, the recalcitrance of printmaking appealed to you. Mm-hmm. And could you talk us through maybe a little bit these early prints? This was the cover of a very early and important show for you.
This was the first recognition that a print of mine got. It was a show organized by Gunter Thiem, a former head of the print department at the museum in Stuttgart, and he was doing a traveling exhibition with the title "The German Woodcut in the 20th Century." And it's kind of interesting if you are asked with 24 to take part in something like that. And he wanted a specific print of mine, which we will see in a few minutes.
This.
The one in the middle.
Here you can.
That's just.
Just advance with.
Here. This print in the middle. It's called Room, and that's on the left. You see that chair, and those were the first. I think the one on the left is actually the first print that I ever did, and I to this day kept it because in trying to do my first works, I wanted to have it really really simple, mm-hmm. and I realized in doing that print, if I put that chair that gives the illusion of three-dimensionality and being there, I would just have to place it on some paper mm-hmm. and thereby creating a space. And in the first, I used to these abstract bars. I didn't even use another object. Mm-hmm. And the second print was the one where I introduced other objects, and I really realized that if I have this tree-like thing on the right, I already have sort of some, a situation where I'm in a room and look out. And mm-hmm. I started to compose these things. Later, I added figures and other elements to them. But those were the very first prints. They were printed on newsprint. A very bad idea, but a beautiful material to print on. On a large roll, I went to the local newspapers. At the time, there was still analog printing. And there's almost 50 meters left on a roll when you print from it because the machine can't use it anymore. So I went to the newspaper and they gave me those rolls. Okay. So I had an endless, completely cheap supply, and I did the first prints just with my hand mm-hmm. And just rubbing them through. And there's nothing more delicate and beautiful to print on and to print with than this, but it's absolutely unstable and it stains terribly, and so there's another issue, but to print from it is wonderful. And I was using my oil paint, so there's no printing ink. And I changed to regular printing ink about 10 years later when I was in New York. The print in the middle, this is the one that Mr. Thiem wanted. And he called me and I said, well, I can't give it to you because I have sold it. I won an art prize with it, that's where he saw it, but I made only one. And he said, I'm not accepting that answer. I'm going to visit you in 2 weeks' time, and you will have that print for me because I need it for my exhibition. And then I thought of, I didn't really know what to do. It was a great honor to be asked, and I didn't know him, but it was a person to be respected. He was a really an interesting man, a build a great collection. And so I thought, I'm making a mirror image. And we never talked about this. He didn't ask me, I didn't say anything. He had his print, and I made several, in trying to recreate that print, obviously I had to make 3, 4, 5, mm-hmm. and this is the one that I kept.
Okay. And the dealer, Wolfgang Widrock, also saw your prints at this moment as well.
I think he got a hint from Gunter Thiem and said, this is this is interesting work, you might want to look at it. And he came to see me in the studio in Berlin in 1985. These prints are from 1983, still done while I was in art school. Mm-hmm. And 2 years later, I basically understood what I had done. Mm. At that time, I didn't really understand what was going mm-hmm. on. I just knew and realized there's something more interesting than in my paintings. Mm. So the one on the right is one of the earliest prints that I've done in Berlin in 1985. And that's when I met Wolfgang Wittrock. He was helping build up a collection for Deutsche Bank. And that's why he was interested in works on paper of like emerging artists.
And it's his generosity that brought in some of the works in our collection as well.
The first work that was introduced to the National Gallery, I think.
Yes, in honor of the 50th anniversary. Yeah. So I think we have a close-up of that one. So quite quickly, you're shifting, looking at domestic interiors, mm-hmm. Often taking bits and pieces of those domestic interiors and kind of reflecting them backwards. Mm-hmm. And there's maybe kind of a study of your surroundings. And perhaps that idea of studying things around you made you appeal to Daniel Bell as well, a sociologist.
As subject matter, I usually take things that are close at hand, mm-hmm. And I need to be really familiar with them so that I don't even think about it anymore. It's just, it has to be like part of my surroundings. Authenticity was for me in that sense maybe important, but mm-hmm. not in the sense that it's a precarious situation or a special situation. Mm-hmm. I like sort of the subject matter to be completely ordinary, and I'm working in almost every object is life size, sometimes mm-hmm. slightly bigger, sometimes slightly smaller, so I don't have to do much for a representation. And this was these first prints that felt like now I'm a king in my own kingdom. I can declare this to be a chair, or mm-hmm. I can declare this to be a tree, and I can sort of open up my whole space and build my little theater here. And I had even these funny theories that certain colors are, I remember that when I was seeing the Munch show, that certain colors are female and others are male, and I was making up these whole lists of ideas, but in a very arbitrary way.
Mm-hmm. And so here, I guess you might be similarly experimenting with colors, and these are also prints. So that one mm-hmm. is the Widrock print.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
But Daniel Bell also came, and somehow he found you in London, is that
he
right?
He found me in London. He saw a print of mine at an exhibition in the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, and I think it was called The Unique Print, and it was one print of this Essence theory that
okay.
we just had.
So it was one of,
yeah,
of
the one on the right-hand side. A more abstract one even, in black and white on brown paper, and just two people seated at opposite mm. ends of a table. And he wanted to track down this artist, and he asked his friend, another sociologist, Wolf Lepenies in Berlin, try to find this man. And his secretary found my studio, which was called Institut Unzeit, sort of institute that's fallen out of time, and it was a place where late fluxes and sort of experimental music was, hmm. I mean, most people were into music, and I was one of the visual artists there. Mm-hmm. And Matthias Osterwald, who ran that, he had studied sociology. So when Daniel Bell calls there, he was obviously completely amazed because this was one of his heroes. And Matthias also knew where I was. Hmm. And I was at the time in London in 1986. And Daniel Bell had a sabbatical or a teaching assignment in Cambridge, England. And he came to the studio and he selected, I think, all 8 prints here. But he was with a London dealer that told him to slow down. So he took 1, 2, 3, and 4. But he had selected this one, this one, this one, and I think this one. I'm not totally sure about that one. And so he goes back to the States and he takes those four prints. And like a couple of months later, he asks me, do you still have the colored ones? And I said, I kept them aside. Because I sort of had the feeling he would come back and I wanted them to be together. So I was really, really happy that he had this whole group of eight. So this series is well represented by these eight prints.
And apparently he used to, so great that we have got them from him, and he apparently used to change the configuration in his hallway of them, that he would move them around.
Yeah.
So sort of interesting how the, perhaps yeah, the collector.
Yeah, he was quite, this was the, I mean, he was a not only a very important scientist and a great writer, but he was one of those, for me, it was amazing because he was this New York intellectual of a whole group and generation, and he had a strong love for the German language because he grew up speaking Yiddish before he spoke English, and his idols were sort of the working class movement in New York, and he was working for a communist newspaper in his youth. And so when every time he came to Germany or we met, for him that was great also to speak German, to remember his youth, he would sing these communist songs. I remember going down Kurfürstendamm and he would start singing the Internationale, and that was kind of really fun. And so when he saw these things, and I said, this is the studio, this set is called Studio, and he said, I think you should add Von Kopf bis Fuß, because he remembered the Marlene Dietrich song, and that's stuck, and so this is why the title is so complicated.
Kind of yet one more little collaboration with the, yes. with Bell giving you the name.
Mm-hmm.
So we titled the installation configuration, so thinking mm-hmm. about both changing things around, mm-hmm. but of course in that word is figuration.
Mm-hmm.
And the human figure in kind of often multiplied mm-hmm. Is something that's long interested you. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, when I did these first interiors that we looked at, objects were simple. I didn't have to do much for representation. I could just place them and they created space and a stage set for my ideas. But what to do with the figure? And when I started, I knew I didn't want two things. I didn't want people to think about, is the figure dressed or is she naked? This was not supposed to play any role. I just wanted it to have presence or evidence or something that is just there.
Mm-hmm.
So I wondered how I could do that, and that's when I discovered that if you carve something, you always have to decide on a structure or pattern of carving, and every printmaking, at least in the technical ways of printmaking, have something to do with we call it raster. Like offset printing has dots. Digital
pattern.
Images has pixels. Raster.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, if I take an arbitrary raster,
mm-hmm.
so I can choose my own, I can make my own, and I'm still using this idea that if you cluster light or darkness, you suggest imagery.
Mm-hmm.
Like going down a staircase
uh-huh.
into a cellar, and you're gonna meet your friends or family. And even if it's almost pitch dark, you recognize them by the way uh-huh. the light and shade is organized mm-hmm. in the face. You don't need outlines. You don't need specific mm-hmm. things, but you still recognize it as a figure. And so I understood that in order that I can call this a figure, or somebody would perceive this as evidence of the figure, it was almost nothing I needed to do, especially give you a few dots of light. And that's how I cut the first one. On the left, you see a head.
Could you maybe just translate the titles for the audience?
Yeah, it says Männerkopf leicht seitlich. It means a head of a man seen from the side, and it's from the left. Yeah. See, it's hard to translate. It's just seen slightly at mm-hmm. an angle or
yep.
something.
So kind of three-quarter view. So, yep.
And I made a portfolio. This the same portfolio that's now will be on view in Boston at the MFA. And I had like about 10 tools, and I selected maybe 7 out of them.
Mm.
And I thought to try to make an individual raster with each of the tools that I had. And I had used until this point. Mm. And when I did the first head, I think this could have been the first head, I'm not sure anymore, I understood that this creates like a character. Mm. Unfortunately, we don't have, you have to believe this now. If I take straight strokes, the character is a different person. If I take dots, just punching dots in, it's a different person. And realizing that, so I could individualize without giving any representational forms to things. That was the discovery in that. And I was using these for the other figures that I just selected a structure to carve them with, thereby giving them a sort of identity and mm-hmm. even an emotion.
Just so people, so this is sitting, standing, lying.
Sitting, standing, and reclining. And that is a work from a large printing project. It's the last one that I'd done in New York, while working in New York. I had a studio there from 1989 to 1994.
And you were in Bushwick before the hipsters and the
gentrifiers. Oh yeah, I was in Williamsburg and then in downtown Brooklyn and then at last on Franklin Street in Tribeca. And every time, slightly before, it became really chic. but the Brooklyn studio was quite wild. And it was wonderful. There was Louise Bourgeois had her studio on the ground floor. And so always in all these places, there were very interesting people. And in the last one in Tribeca, was Mel Bochner was working one flight up. And so there was always an interesting surrounding.
So maybe some people in the audience will remember both Bochner and Bourgeois' work. We show them often at this institution, Bourgeois most recently. two very important 20th century artists.
So, but just one more sentence to that project. If you make a book and you create a page, in order to bind it, you have to fold it. And you can fold it once, you can fold it twice, you can fold it four times. In this case, I thought of a page that's folded two times. Mm. And what you see is an unfolded page. But this book, I've eventually created, it's now in the Folkwang Museum in Essen. The book is like 3 by 3 feet, and I have to make the circle. Oh, sorry, I did something totally wrong.
I think it's just the muting function.
Okay, so this is one seam where you crease it, and this is the other. And so what's now the part of the head and the feet are upside down will be right side up.
Once you fold it.
And I like to do project on sort of basic and specific mm-hmm. sort of craft mm-hmm. things. And in making a book, you have to do this.
Yes.
And right. So in the end, I like these sheets. So I kept up one set of sheets unfolded and mm-hmm. one I folded into a book.
But they still have, of course, have the trace of that kind of codex structure.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So your very beginnings with figuration mm-hmm. Are perhaps, it almost seems sort of a bit more kind of primitive in some ways, but we might also relate them to other experiments with figuration or things that are just verging on the mm-hmm. figurative. So Barnett Newman's Zips maybe could be almost mm-hmm. the kind of zero-degree figuration, Giacometti's mm-hmm. Standing Woman. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little bit about these works?
This is a series called A Woman in a Man's Forest. And it was about, again, this is a series I did right after Studio in Köpfe und Füße in a new studio in Dalston, an old hospital, and this is where Daniel Bell came to see the work. Okay. But I was working on these. And I thought, I was asked to do an edition for, I think, Deutsche Bank. And in some ways, I resented the idea of doing an edition. And so I thought that I make a print portfolio where I document all the steps that lead to the final print. Mm. And the first is that I just printed the blocks without carving them, without doing nothing to them, that would I would turn into the male figures. So on the left-hand side, you have maybe one of the first prints. On the right, you see that they're already slightly worked with an axe and with a chisel so that they get some human kind mm-hmm. illusions. And then we should go on. And in the 35th print or something, you will have like a reclining woman and this tree-like. And it always went back from being board, being figure, being tree. Mm-hmm. And with the with the female figure. That's not, we don't see that now. It went from just a figure to just a meadow to just, I don't know, a blanket to kind of...
Mm-hmm. So these different elements could take on a whole variety of different lives, mm-hmm. depending on how you intervened in them. Mm-hmm. So let's keep moving forwards. And I think one interesting quote of yours that I came across is that you said, "I don't cut lines, I cut light." And so we've got some instances of this. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you were quite interested in photography, which maybe wouldn't be the most natural comparison for someone who sees your work for the first time.
Mm. I've always been inspiring, and I think before I became an artist, I loved to take photographs, but more so I loved working in the darkroom.
Mm.
And then going to art school, I completely forgot about it. But when I was back in London, and I started to be... I mean, the Studio Kopf und Füße series and that series we just mm-hmm. talked about, the Frau im Männerwald, there were series that were very painterly and that depended on, in large part, on overlaying printing mm-hmm. matrices and changing them. But then I started with a series of works where I didn't overprint at all, but where I tried to carve everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I was interested in these Muybridge photographs of showing human and animal mm-hmm. Locomotion, because I now you see it of this walking figure on the right. This is a later print. This is done in 94 in Berlin after being back from New York.
Mm.
I started with a black block and just had one, the left hand side part carved. So in this, there's six images. This one was carved and the rest was black. And then I carved the second state and the rest was black, mm-hmm. and so forth. And this is the sixth state, basically. And I was interested in this, like it was for me, it was like this man would walk always behind a curtain.
Mm.
So you would always get half of it. And only the last one I sort of made, I complemented the figure
uh-huh.
into one.
And I think your idea about the different character of the different types of white line marks is really tangible here. So when you were mentioning that before, I think here that we can see it, that there is this kind of transformation.
Yeah, you can see very clearly that this is a different character and it has a different attitude mm-hmm. to figure. But if you go back to the print that's at the Museum of Modern Art, that was a strategy that I developed here. Is if you look at the left print on the left-hand side, this is the plate, and it's always the same plate. You can see it on these marks. It's here. It's hard to find, but it's there. So I would carve that seated figure, print it.
Mm-hmm.
Carve again, the figure slightly trying to get up from the chair, even more so, like almost upright, with a different text, and every time taking a different structure, related but different. And I did several sequences like that, and there I realized that I could make figures do almost anything. Like they could move, they could take on different character, they could stand in for something else than they began in the beginning with. But I think this was done in 1988,
mm-hmm.
and I worked in this medium almost 10 years before I made a print that I specifically editioned, even in a small edition of 3 or 5. But I would always go forward and
mm-hmm.
see, use the medium really as a documenting process of the documenting means of an artistic process.
Mm-hmm.
I very rarely thought of it as being being prints in a way,
uh-huh.
because they were life-size figures. It was more a dialogue with painting, I think, mm-hmm. still.
And maybe also, I mean, perhaps also a little bit like sort of photography or
yeah.
even film.
Yeah, I mean, the ideas
animation.
Came from film sometimes. This idea came from a dancer in London, Gabi Agis, that I saw, and that she, her dance was, in a way, the defining of everyday movements.
Mm.
And that struck me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I combined it with this idea of Muybridge to kind of sequence
And I think here it perhaps is even clearer your connection with Moybridge, with the
Work that's just trial proofs, and there's some blocks where you can see these chalk lines. Mm. This series is called Trieste or the Gods, and it goes back to an experience that I had 2 summers ago in Trieste. I don't know whoever has been there, but the whole city lives on a small strip of, you can't even call it a beach, it's next to a road. It's about 5 miles next to a road connecting the city to a castle. And there is big boulders leading down to the sea. Every 100 meters there is a ladder so you can get in, and every 500 meters there's a little kiosk where you can buy your espresso. And the whole town basically is on a stretch that is not wider than the field where we're sitting on. And I looked at these bathers there, and I was struck that I thought, oh, these Italians, they are just amazing. They are taking on postures of Greek sculptures. And that's just, how do they do this? And I started photographing some, just kind of a little bit, it was a bit awkward. I didn't want to be seen too much doing that. But I was struck by the postures and what they conjured up. And there's lots of things. Even one man was standing like the statue that Rodin did for Balzac and others. So they were taking up these poses. Mm-hmm. And I was very much thinking about these poses. And now I'm trying to make prints with them. And but here, what's interesting, I think, for you to see is that I start with a chalk drawing on a blackboard, and usually I wipe it all away, and then I start carving when I know the figure well enough. But in some cases, like when it gets too complicated, I leave some of the outlines.
So it helps to guide your cutting process.
I did this. We're going to get, I think, to a series of cityscapes, and because they use perspective, I really had to leave some of the lines in place.
So let's keep moving. So another thing, a kind of interesting shift in your work happens with about the house. So you're both kind of moving outwards in space, but still very much focusing on kind of work and labor that's happening in this house. Can you talk a little bit about this series? It was certainly a major breakthrough for you.
Yeah, the series about the house was sort of the, like, combines everything that I had done in these 5 years in New York almost. It was like a stock-taking in some ways, because I had worked in London, I had worked in Paris, and I reacted to the city streets and scapes and to my being welcome there or not welcome them, just try to find my way through. But in New York, I was at a moment where I sort of started reflecting what I had done so far. It was like a 10-year period of work before that. And so I tried to kind of bring that all in, and I tried to create this house with these different rooms, and the first room, or the last one, whatever you want to call it, is that studio.
And just one more, so here's all of them.
Yeah, these are three panels.
Another recurring element is this green chair, so going back to your very first print.
So I tried to include all the methods, the means, and the whole domestic, this series was for a while called Daily Duties, because this is what we all have to go through in this domestic life, and I tried to bring it all in. Each of these panels, there are three of them, is as long as the wall here, approximately.
And when we asked you to come here to give a conversation, you talked about, you gave us the name Steps Toward Reality.
Yeah.
And that seems to me to kind of most clearly sync up with these, which sort of occupy the space of the actual size of the rooms to some extent.
Yeah.
Can you talk through how people might view these works?
You could see it as one person going to all these motions, or you could see it as a house full of people that are doing all these everyday chores. Like on the right here, you have the bathroom scene. And you have somebody sitting on the toilet, brushing teeth, towel in the bathtub, shaving, or here the basic positions in the sleeping in the bed, a sleeping figure, seated figure, looking at the wardrobe, mirror image, and so forth. I try to cover all that, but mm-hmm. that's kind of the nucleus, and that's where it relates to the image of the studio that's here. Thinking of what is actually happening. Here you have the artist, no clue, no idea, empty table. Here you have, it's sort of comic-like in a way too. Here you have sort of an overlay, you have the figure that didn't know what to do, suddenly doing something and carving his own figure. So, and it's maybe even a doctor kind of taking parts away. Mm-hmm. And you have the light bulbs, the studio. And then it kind of starts moving. Here you have somebody seated looking at that. So this figure is here. You can basically see the hands. And if you concentrate on those hands, it's the same kind of chisel mallet that you have in the prints here in the National Gallery. Again, somebody watching that scene and so forth. And you could connect it like by storytelling, but you can also see that I try to, with a very simple gesture, carving these, giving the plate a space so that you would think it's a 2-3-dimensional, mm-hmm. and then putting in things, objects, like a chair, it becomes more 3-dimensional. This would be a dining room scene. No, this is the kitchen dining room scene here. And then people talking, party, coming through the door, walking up the stairways. And anyway, so this it's a long, I just added narrative, but in a way, I also added all my possibilities that I had developed so far in carving.
And I think it's interesting, so you're sort of thinking in a kind of serial fashion, thinking about all of the different possibilities of use for these spaces. Mm. Another thing that I thought was striking that you mentioned to me when we were talking about these, and again, perhaps my art historian's eye forces me to think about these connections, but Lisitsky, who is moving kind of planes both of wood but also of color out into space. And you said, when we were discussing these, you said, this is a question of working and thinking about planes, not plates. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about that idea?
Yeah, because I was struck that most people that look at the woodcut in the beginning, especially, it was awkward. I signed them especially so you couldn't do that. Because there was a white sheet of paper and there was a print, the print that was taken from a plate, and the more square it was, the more people tended to just show the printed surface and not the paper. And in order to avoid that, I tried to sign it as low on the bottom as possible, so you would have to chop the signature off. But when I develop these prints, I don't see them as like this plate and there's something that I carve into this plate, but I see it as this is my space, this is my paper I want to use, and then I take the plate and then just walk around and place it, and then I take another one and place that too, so, so on one hand, this is just a square piece, and it's dark and black. And if you ink it and have inked it and cleaned it up, it's just black. That's what it is. And so you're moving an object on around the surface and decide where it's supposed to go. But the other thing is that it also carries an image, and that image carries a suggestion of space, sometimes of three-dimensional space. And these two planes, they kind of intertwine. And create the pictorial space then.
And you mentioned it almost as thinking about a kind of staging.
Yeah.
So maybe a sort of theatricality is creeping in to some extent too.
I mean, we have a German word that I have no idea how you try to translate that. And I think we call it Ort, ein Ort. And Ort is something that is different from room, but it's I think it's also a philosophy concept behind it. And so it's a... It's a specific space where things are or could be. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that's the pictorial, that's my paper, that's the pictorial plane. And then I add objects and change that. And I can change the atmosphere by colors. I can change the way you perceive it by another object. So that's... It's hard for me to explain this now, and you're getting confused. We have to.
So maybe let's keep going, and perhaps we can talk a little bit about the Bather series that we. So this is the work that is in configurations.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly you're using very bright kinds of colors.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that Munch was certainly a possible connection.
No, this is a starting point in some ways for that series. Because I was given a scholarship in a small sea resort on the Baltic coast called Warnemünde. And Edvard Munch has worked there in 1907 and 1908, and he wanted to regain his health and virility and start life all over, go away from these dark bourgeois nights in Berlin, mm-hmm. and do something that's kind of out in the open, out in the sun, naked bodies and so forth. And I think he also was challenged by Beckmann with his Bayless picture, and so he really wanted to react that, and Hodler, I think, was a big influence for that painting. And at the time I was given that stipend, it was the same house he had painted in, so I could work in the exact same space.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, this is a seaside resort. And the third element was that the curator of the Rostock Kunsthalle, then Annie Bardon, had prepared a show about the paintings of Munch in Warnemünde.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had all the paintings there. I had the actual house, except for that wonderful major piece in the Ateneum in Helsinki. At that point, the Ateneum wouldn't give that on loan. Now it's on tour all the time, but then it didn't. So I didn't see the original.
Mm.
I saw all the paintings around it. And in some ways, I tried to react and create my own picture of bathers with this historical layer of the Munch painting and the actual bathing scenes on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And so both these, you call it experiences, I try to include in that work.
And I think here we can get a really good sense of how your blocks might connect to an image.
Yeah, so I think we have arrayed all the blocks that go into that final image. If you have this one here, no, this one. This one is that one. This dark blue one is the big wave. This one is the little wavelets that are behind that figure in green. And this green, like seagrass or something, is here. And the figure, the female figure, standing like up to her, like her knees are in the water, that's this plate. And this plate is combined of three plates. And the pattern that's creating the figure in a way is an illusion, because that's the pattern of the wavelets.
Mm, okay.
Because I printed this in this light orange as last on top of that. And I inked these little elements with the other little specks of light in blue. Oh, here, that one. So it's a composite image, and that's something that I'd seen. Munch was doing these layers. He would, for the bathers, he would make study paintings, and he would have like one layer for sky, for clouds, another one for water in the distance, another one for water in the middle ground, and then a wave in the foreground. And I separated that even further. So I took from him less the emotion, less this idea of the healthy life and all that, but I took sort of the principles that he's built his image and separated them even further. And then I recombined them to create an illusion of an actual possible scene. And this, sort of what I called in the beginning, this dreamlike image. I was walking the beach, and there was a storm cloud coming up, and the sun was low. It was late afternoon. So all the brown, skinny, like summer sunburned people were standing in the water, and they had this very bright light on their bodies against a gray thunder cloud sky. And so that's an actual image I saw.
So a happy accident again.
Sort of, all the figures, I saw them. Some of them I drew, some of them I made little paintings or watercolors to memorize. And then I started the whole process of printing, of cutting the blocks, of finding the blocks, and putting them together. Maybe you want to show the big one too.
So the larger one looks like this. Yeah. So you can see all of the different figures, and then see how our figure fits into a bigger configuration.
Composition, yes.
So I think we're getting close to the end of our time. So maybe let's jump forwards and talk a bit about your work at the Smithsonian. So maybe if people have questions about this series, so a series of views of Paris, we can come back to it. But this is what you were mentioning about the blackboard drawings.
Mm-hmm.
And over these. So this is your most recent project. So you were a Smithsonian Artist Research Fellow.
Yes, I was looking into the United States Exploring Expedition of 1838 to 1842, led by Lieutenant Charles Wilkes, in some ways infamous as Captain Ahab in Melville's story.
Mm-hmm.
And I was interested in the artists that went along, and I was looking at all the printing matrices, preliminary drawings, and objects. And in doing so, I kept like a photographic diary.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, this turned, I think there is some strange aesthetic about the way science treats objects and behaves, and I can't pinpoint
mm-hmm.
that was a fascination. That's why I took, for instance, this photograph. And I think, for me, the interesting thing is that how do we record things? How do we perceive things? What happens? And so I was very happy to have given that time to reflect only on these along these lines and to see this sort of. I could go now in many different directions because it hasn't gone into artwork yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of pre that. It's just a backdrop for thought.
Mm-hmm. And so I think the work will eventually, right now you're mulling things over, but will use your artwork as a way of kind of entering into the discourse about science, maybe giving
about perception, mm-hmm. I think, and representation and things like that.
And you actually were not allowed to photograph one thing.
Yeah, one thing. On the left-hand side, you see a drawing that I made of the skull of a Fiji chief, Vendovi, that was abducted by the expedition for trial in America, and he died on arrival in New York. And on the right-hand side, you see a late 19th century mold taken after a clay mask. And that's a fantastic story, and I'm sure that I'm going to run with that.
So I think it's great to see that art can engage with research and bring ideas that perhaps have fallen by the wayside to light, and that we can approach them with the critical distance that history allows us.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll just finish with one more image that caught your eye around Washington. So tell us, what is this?
This is... it stands in front of archives, and at the trail of that expedition in the early 19th century, I was struck by these Enlightenment-inspired inscriptions in the Federal Triangle, and that is one that captured me most. That's why I wanted to put it at the end of the talk, in a way.
No, please. So it comes from The Tempest.
Mm.
So perhaps it's appropriate to Matthias's interest in bathers and the way that we've kind of seen the bather before the storm, maybe not so different to The Tempest that perhaps we're still experiencing right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think also nice in relationship to your own working process, where you said you're perhaps a little bit snail-like.
I think the sort of the themes that I carry, or the it's like an intertwine. Sometimes I develop a pictorial idea,
mm-hmm.
let's say of the ordinary object, the house, and it kind of grows and grows and grows. But I also hope, at least, that I develop means of doing things. And these intertwine and they intersect. Sometimes I had the feeling that this is like a snail's house. I'm coming by the same path, mm-hmm. but in an outer layer. And so I'm adding outer layers to it, I hope at least.
So,
and,
I think on that note, maybe we'll open up for maybe just two or three questions in the audience. So over here first. Mm-hmm. I'll repeat your question.
You were saying earlier, when you started doing wooden blocks, that seemed to be like something was there that wasn't in your painting.
Yes.
So the question is, what was in woodblock printing that was not that was seemed to be lacking from painting?
For me personally, the precision of the of a decision, because if I cut something, it's absolute. If I use a brush, if you ever held a brush, and you have canvas, you put that brush towards the canvas, it goes boop. It's just not very precise. And you can make it very precise, but it's a tactile feeling that was different. That was important for me to have clear. And the second is the precision of decision. If I cut, let's say, if I cut this table in half, it's gone. The other half is gone. Or if I chisel something out, it cannot be replaced. And that, for me, was a way of moving forward, moving an image, and telling you my decisions in a way. I'm opening sort of my artwork, I think, is not about only creating images, but also opening it up as a discursive, what do you call it?
Like in a discursive field?
In a discursive field, so that I'm trying to engage you, myself, like to try to follow and run with an image and see what happens. And I'm not, let's say for instance, now we're looking at a landscape, I'm not standing at some point looking in the landscape, and this is the Berlin Tiergarten, and telling you this is the way it looks. But I walk through the park, and certain images stuck in my head, like raindrops falling, like a fallen tree, like a mirror image of some poplar trees. And I bring them together on a sheet of paper. And I'm hoping by doing so that I'm giving it's like a loose and open-ended storytelling. Everybody can create his own fall image out of these clues in a way. So that's something that fascinates me. And that's something I couldn't do. I tried to do it in painting, but it was mostly destructive. And it didn't, and I felt that the same attitude that tended to be destructive in painting is constructive in the woodcut medium. I think that's maybe.
So I think Andrew and then this lady behind him.
Mm-hmm. The relationship between your prints and paintings, I'm going to go on with that, because as far as I know, almost all of your prints are unique.
Yeah.
So that it's not the multiplicity of printmaking that attracts you. You mentioned the decisiveness and so forth, but that has a kind of backhanded problem. And suppose I say, I love that 1991 David.
Yes.
That came to the National Gallery. I'd like to have that in my house.
Yeah. No, this is
possible.
The tension of multiplicity and uniqueness in printmaking. And what about if a collector wanted something in particular?
There had to be a way out for myself, because I need to make a living. And so I decided, I think it was in New York when I was there, and I just couldn't. So when I did a series like The Bathers, I would edition the last state in a very large one. I made 3 copies. And from the one that's the single figure, I made 5 copies. And these 5 copies are close. I mean, most people wouldn't notice that they're different. A discerning person like you would see that the handprinting would give different qualities to each one of them. But basically, I intend them to give you the same feeling.
But you know that it's the largest edition that you've made for round 5?
Most of the time, yes. There is an exception. There are these individual rooms of the About the House series. Mm. And there I did editions of 20.
It's very interesting you choose 5, because it's exactly the same with Ernst Ludwig Kirchner.
Yeah?
Kirchner hated to do more than a few impressions of any print. And when he was forced to do that condition of the head of shamans. Mm. He couldn't stand it. He complained constantly.
Nice.
Same thing again.
All right, and so let's have our last question now.
Mm-hmm. So forgive me, I actually have two questions. The first
That's
one
great.
Is, the first question is following on the idea of each cut being a decision. So
yes.
Are there no bad decisions? Do you ever replace it, or is every decision a decision that you have to have the artifact of the decision? And then my second question. Can I ask the second
question? Yes, yes.
Second question is, have you ever studied architecture?
No. No. I had lots of architect friends, but I'd never... I'm interested in the mechanics of how things are put together, but my architect friends always laugh about myself, and one is, who is also a Norwegian painter, and he said, you always take the most complicated and laborsome process possible. So, but covering things, yes, you make mistakes and things go wrong, but mostly I find not because you misuse your craft or because a line goes the wrong way, but because you didn't or I didn't think it through before I did something. So if I know what I want to do and I'm clear about it and I know there's this little person sitting on my shoulder and tells me, just stop, wait a second, think about it, go for a walk and then come back, then it usually works. Because I'm not very concerned, this might surprise you, the way the print looks in the end. If I'm confident that I've taken the right decisions that felt right while doing so, I'm pretty sure that the final result will look interesting. But if not, that's not the case, it's kind of pointless and you throw it away and you start something else. But there is an interesting aspect of every time I start a new series, it's a very painful and long process before I actually do so, because I've been working in that medium now for 35 years, and with each series that you in some ways successfully finish, you're raising some sort of standard in a way, but in order to make a new one, you have to be as helpless and hopeless as before the first print you ever did. And this tension doesn't get any easier, but so that's just, I think that's for every artist the same problem, to be vulnerable again and to be just to be open.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on openness and potentiality and new possibilities. So thank you all very much for coming out this afternoon. And hopefully, if you haven't seen it, you can make your way over to the West Building and see Matthias Manson Configurations. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.